Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, January 6, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing statewide versus local right-to-work laws. My name is Nate Kaczmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are pleased to have with us Mr. James Shirk, who is a research fellow in labor economics at the Heritage Foundation, Professor Ariana Levinson, who is a professor of law at the University of Louisville Brandeis School of Law, Mr. Andrew Kloster, a Washington, D.C.-based attorney, and our moderator, Mr. Raymond J. Lajeunesse, Jr., who is the Vice President and Legal Director at the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. I will turn it over to Ray, who will get us started with opening remarks. After opening remarks and group discussion, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you all for speaking with us. Ray, the floor is yours.
Okay, thanks, Nate. Section 8A3 of the National Labor Relations Act authorizes agreements requiring union and the use of the term membership, quote-unquote, as a condition of employment after 30 days of employment. However, the term membership has been construed by the U.S. Supreme Court, cases culminating in Communications Workers versus Beck in 1988, to mean only payment of the part of union dues used for representation and collective bargaining, not formal membership nor payment of full dues, including the part used for politics and other non-bargaining activities. The case in 1949 called Algoma Plywood, the Supreme Court, based on legislative history of the original National Labor Relations Act, or otherwise known as the Wagner Act, held that Section 83 left states free to prohibit or regulate such forced unionism agreements. Algoma Plywood also recognized that in the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act, Congress had added Section 14B to the Act to make explicit that, quote, any state or territory, unquote, is permitted to prohibit or regulate compulsory union fee agreements. Statutes prohibiting forced union fee agreements are popularly known as right-to-work laws, and I'll refer to them as that now. Until November 18 last year, the only courts that had decided whether the NLRA permits political subdivisions of states to enact right-to-work laws had held that the answer is no. Kentucky's highest state court in 1965, U.S. District Court for New Mexico in 1990, and the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Kentucky last year in a challenge to one of 12 local ordinances recently enacted in that state. However, on November 18, in UAW Local 3046 versus Hardin County, a three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit reversed the district court and held that the term state in Section 14B includes political subdivisions and the local ordinance in Hardin County is not preempted. A petition for rehearing en banc is pending in Hardin County, and our panelists are here today to discuss the pros and cons of this thorny issue. And we'll begin with James Shirk from the Foundation, Heritage Foundation, who incidentally is a co-author with Andrew Kloster of a paper on the very issue of local right-to-work laws. James?
Thank you, Ray. So I'm going to talk just to start out to explain why many of these local governments are looking to pass local right-to-work laws. We've seen there are a dozen counties in Kentucky. This is the issue in the litigation. There's a city in Illinois. There's talk of localities in other states pushing this. And there's two main reasons that local governments and policymakers in general support right-to-work laws. Incidentally, Kentucky probably by Saturday is going to be a right-to-work state. The State House just passed yesterday a statewide right-to-work law. The State Senate is expected to pass it Saturday, and the governor is expected to sign it. But the two main reasons for supporting right-to-work are personal liberty and economic development. And to start with the personal liberty side, without right-to-work, union contracts are typically going to force workers to pay union dues or get fired. They can't be required to pay the full amount of union dues. The agency fees that covers the representational expenses are typically around 85%. 10% of the full dues. And this is going to run most workers somewhere between $500 to $1,000 a year. Now, union representation for some workers is worth it. You know, for some workers, you know, they see a benefit they're receiving, and they're willing to pay that cost, and this is not a hardship to them. But there's many other workers for whom this is money that they don't want to be spending, that you know, they would rather not have that union representation, or they wouldn't be willing to pay that much for that union representation. There's been some really interesting new research that's come out from some MIT economists, where they've basically taken a look at administrative records of every company that's unionized since 1980 and cross-referenced that with data that we have, you know, tax record data from the government on how much workers get paid. And what they find is that overwhelmingly, when unions organize a company, wages don't go up. We're simply in a much more competitive environment right now. The unions don't have the same scope for negotiating higher pay than they did, say, back in the 1940s when they're organizing Detroit. So if the vast majority of unionized companies, the union can come in and promise a great deal, but if they're not negotiating higher pay, why should the workers then be forced to pay for that? Particularly when provisions in the union contract often hurt individual workers. If you're a new hire, seniority-based layoffs and seniority-based promotions are not for you. They mean that you're pretty much at the end of the line. Similarly, if you are a highly productive worker, then seniority-based pay increases mean that you, no matter how productive you are, you're not getting promoted and you're not getting raises any faster than everyone else, even if you're working three times as hard. There's a lot of companies, a lot of workers at unionized companies who really don't like their union contract. You know, it may be, say, you're in a manufacturing town, this is the company you've got to work in if you want a job, but they'd much rather not have that union contract. And in fact, what the economic research shows is the overwhelming majority of workers who opt out of paying dues, the union dues, are those workers who value the benefits of the union less than the amount of the dues. Either they'd rather not have the union at all, or whatever benefits they're getting from the contract are less than the amount that the union contract is forcing them to pay. But 70% of union members who opt out are those who are opting out because it's just not worth it for them. And in a free society, we generally allow people to make these decisions. You know, AT&T does not get to allow me to, it is not allowed to force me to purchase their services. Samsung is not allowed to force us to purchase their services. Private membership organizations, Americans for Tax Reform, the NRA, the ACLU, Planned Parenthood, all these organizations have to voluntarily persuade people to provide them with donations or to sign up as a member. Unions are a somewhat unique exception to this. And so in a free society, and the polling shows overwhelmingly Americans believe that, by the way, 2-1 majority of Democrats believe that we ought to have a choice about whether or not you pay union dues. You ought not be threatened with the loss of your job if you don't cough up. And that's especially true because of the way unions have become such a heavily politicized interest group. Unions today spend about $1 billion each election cycle, over $1 billion on politics and lobbying. Virtually all of that goes to support candidates and causes on the left side of the political spectrum. And many union members have different views of this. I mean, you can obviously take a look at what happened in Ohio and Michigan, where Donald Trump won union members in those states, despite their own unions and their own dues being overwhelmingly spent to try and persuade them, go with Secretary Clinton instead. If you're a worker who just vehemently opposes the causes your union has got behind, then it's not simply enough to say, well, you don't have to pay the full amount. If you opt out every year in this 15-day window we give you, that you can opt out of the political portion of our dues. If you're a worker who thinks that your union is actively working to make the country a worse place and don't want to support that union, and again, in a free society, you ought to be allowed to make that choice. And so this is the argument that a lot of people find very compelling. And the personal liberty and freedom benefits are one that have driven a lot of support for right-to-work laws. But there's another side that for many policymakers is equally, if not more so, compelling, and that's the economic benefits. The the short summary version is most companies would prefer not to be unionized. And right-to-work laws make union organizers less aggressive. And so companies disproportionately tend to locate in right-to-work states. Now, this isn't true of every company in the United States. There's a lot of industries, software development or law to be obvious examples, where there's just not a lot of concern about unionization, and those companies don't care. But for a manufacturing company, right-to-work laws are a major, major factor in where companies locate. And if you want to attract those companies to your community and create jobs in your community, that's a very powerful incentive to pass right-to-work laws. Now, why would unions become less aggressive after a state or a locality passes right-to-work? The only thing that right-to-work affects is their ability to compel forced dues. They can still negotiate over everything else. They negotiate pay, benefits, work rules. The only thing that's affected is the compulsory dues provisions. Well, the fact of the matter is, if you've got a company where the workers have been treated very badly by the management, and they're chomping at the bit for a union, and they just feel that they've been mistreated and they need better treatment, right-to-work state or non-right-to-work state, those workers are going to get unionized. The unions are going to come in, and it's going to be a very straightforward organizing drive, and this happens all the time in right-to-work states. But a lot of companies are not so clear-cut like that. The workers may feel relatively satisfied. The union might feel that it could persuade them to join on with the union. It might not. They've got a judgment call. Most shops that are organized are not the so-called hot shops, where the workers are looking for a union. But there are rather cases where the union is looking for new members and is trying to persuade them. And the union has a cost-benefit calculation to make. We have to spend X amount of hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars on this organizing drive. If we don't succeed, we get none of that back. But if we succeed, we then have the stream of dues payments coming in. And it's very much a business case being made at the end of the day. How do we allocate our organizing resources to try and maximize the revenues for the unions? Well, if you've got compulsory dues and you organize, say, a plant of 1,000 workers, that's about $500,000 a year coming in compulsory dues every year until that plant goes under. But if you've got a right-to-work law, particularly if the workers are fairly satisfied with the company, some number, possibly a large number of those workers are going to say, hey, I really don't need this union representation. What am I paying for? And there's a lot less money that's going to be brought in. So the cost-benefit calculation shifts for those plants where it's much more the union looking for members than the workers looking for a union. And so what the economic research finds, and unions don't really disagree with this, is that union organizing drops considerably. It's not eliminated, but it goes down fairly considerably in right-to-work states and in right-to-work locations. And that, in turn, is very attractive to companies. Economic development consultants report that somewhere between 40 and 50% of manufacturing clients have it a top issue, with about a third of their clients making it it's make or break. We won't even consider locating in a non-right-to-work jurisdiction. And you can see this with the foreign transplant automakers, that it's not an accident that most of their facilities were located in right-to-work southern states. They didn't, if you're just looking at the map, you would have said, well, locate in the industrial Midwest, where you've already got all these facilities and this workforce built up. But they decided to locate in the South because they didn't want to have union organizers breathing down their neck. Boeing opening up their new facility in South Carolina, again, not an accident. And we see this statistically, that in right-to-work counties, if you've got two counties on either side of a state border, on the right-to-work county, you're going to have a third more workers signing on than they – or sorry, you're going to have a third more workers and manufacturing workers in the right-to-work side of the border than in the county on the other side with compulsory dues. It's not an accident that we see this happening. And in fact, the economic research shows that if you control for other factors that you'd expect to affect employment, you still find about 1 percentage point lower unemployment rates in right-to-work states. And so that's a pretty powerful incentive. If you can attract jobs to your community, a lot of local policymakers think that, why shouldn't we go for that? Now, the counter-argument that many unions will make is they go, oh, this is really the right to work for less. And they will point to true statistics, accurate numbers from the Census Bureau, that show that wages, or rather annual incomes, are about $5,000 a year lower in right-to-work states than in non-right-to-work states. And they say, oh, see, you're weakening the unions and undercutting the living standards for everyone. We need stronger unions for a stronger middle class. That's not nearly as clear-cut a case as they like to make it sound, because right-to-work states have lower average wages and incomes, yes, but they also have lower living costs. And what I found with my research is once you control for that difference in living costs and take a complete account of the fact that $1,000 in New York City is very different from $1,000 in Memphis or in Shreveport, Louisiana, then what you find is that private sector workers have the same real purchasing power in right-to-work states and in non-right-to-work states. You do find less pay for government workers. It does appear to be the case that for government employees, right-to-work is essentially reducing the resources available to the government unions to elect sympathetic politicians. They can't get their political allies in office with the same frequency, and therefore you do see about 3 to 5% lower pay in government. But for private sector workers, which is where this case is most frequently made, once you account for that difference in living costs, you don't see much of a difference in wages. It's essentially the same. You could maybe squint and say the wages are higher in the right-to-work states, but I wouldn't hang my hat on that too hard. But the right-to-work for less moniker really doesn't hold up once you examine the difference in living costs. And so when you've got these strong economic development arguments and also these personal liberty arguments, you see that right-to-work is attractive to policymakers in most states. We're very soon going to have 27 right-to-work states, probably 28 when Missouri passes us in a few weeks. And there's a good chance, not a sure thing, but a good chance that New Hampshire will also go right-to-work before the end of the year. And so we're very close to having policymakers in 29 states saying this is a good bet. And local government leaders in states, say in the remaining 21 states, might also be interested in bringing these benefits to their citizens.
Is that it?
Yeah, that's it.
That's it, James. Okay, thank you very much. Professor Levinson, I just wanted to mention that you're primary author of a forthcoming article on a federal preemption of local right-to-work ordinances that will be published in the Harvard Journal on Legislation. So we're very lucky to have you on this panel. Please go ahead.
Thank you. So missing from the panel is someone who actually represents unions or somebody from a progressive economic institute. So I want to briefly mention what they might say if they were on the call, and then talk a little bit about what my own findings in general of right to work are, and then go more into this issue of localities passing right to work, which is what my article is about. So Martin Luther King summed up what many union activists and supporters believe, which is that he opposed right to work, stating, "We must guard against being fooled by false slogans such as right to work. Wherever these laws have been passed, wages are lower, job opportunities are fewer, and there are not civil rights." Obviously, that would be their position on right to work, and they would also hold a different position about the value of unions. They would cite to studies that show that unions raise wages, increase safety in workplaces because there's someone independent of the government in the workplace monitoring safety, and provide more secure employment for employees. When I look at the research on right to work, I find that the claims on both sides are overstated. I do not believe that the data suggests that companies choose to locate to a jurisdiction because it's right to work. Studies have found that the key factors in actual decision making, as opposed to what people say they're going to do, are location to supply routes, proximity to suppliers and buyers, and an educated and skilled workforce. While they often say that lower labor costs will factor in, it's not significant in their actual past behavior. The only data that seems to have been reliably established and established in cases using controls for other factors is that wages are lower in right-to-work states. So the employees who have an issue with working in a union environment have the ability to work elsewhere. Most of the companies in the country are not union workplaces, so they should be able to choose to work elsewhere if they do not want to join the union. The reason that we have this situation is a problem of the commons. So you are all probably familiar with the people who own sheep or cow, and they graze on the commons. And if everybody just grazes as much as they want, then the commons are gone and there's no grass for anybody. So this is the same kind of thing. If everybody opts out of the union and nobody pays any agency fee, which is the term generally used for people who do not join the union and pay only the fee that goes to representational costs, if everybody elects not to pay that fee, then there's no money left to represent anybody. In Nevada, it's true that in some states, union membership decreases with the passage of right to work, but in Nevada, the rate of unionization has continued to increase. It is also unknown whether unions will become more or less aggressive because of unionization, because that depends on the particular workplace. If you have a workplace, say, like the longshore workers or many firefighters, where there's very high solidarity, it may actually make them more aggressive in their treatment of their coworkers, and they may ostracize people who are unwilling to join the union in order to avoid this free rider problem. If you have a place where, as James said, the majority of workplaces that are organized, somebody from the workplace contacts the union, the unions may have to be more aggressive in the organizing and in their internal organizing in places where they already represent people. So that's just in general a little bit about right to work. But in terms of this particular issue about whether these local right to work ordinances are preempted by the National Labor Relations Act, I think it's important to understand or to reemphasize some of what has been said already about how union security works. So in the federal law, in the NLRA, under the court decisions, no employee can be required to join a union, and no employee can be required to pay towards political activities of unions. They pay only for the cost to represent the employees, which are the costs such as negotiating the union contract, or if you're terminated or you're suspended or you have some type of workplace issue, then the union will represent you through the grievance process and possibly into arbitration. Every union has to provide notice to all of the employees that they represent that the employees have the right not to join the union and to pay the reduced fee. And every union has to hire external independent auditors to verify that none of the political money is being charged to employees who do have a different political position than their union. So in every private workplace, employees have the right not to join the union that represents them, and they also have the right to pay only their fair share so that not a cent of their money is spent on speech with which they do not agree. So that's the baseline that we're starting with here. And then we need to understand a little bit about preemption in the labor law context and what's primarily at issue in the Hardin County case and in the other cases that Ray mentioned is Garmin preemption. So Garmin preemption means that the National Labor Relations Act preempts states and localities from acting in the area of labor relations. The reasoning behind this is that it promotes uniformity in labor relations. It lets employers, unions, and employees predict what will happen and not have to change what will happen state by state or locality by locality, not have to spend numerous hours researching into different ordinances or different laws. Its other basis is that we have an expert board, the National Labor Relations Board. The expert board knows about labor relations and is designed to determine when employers and unions are committing what we call unfair labor practices. And the preemption is very broad. It's been recognized by Cindy Esland at NYU as one of the most broad type of preemptions that we have under federal law. And it protects anything that's arguably protected or prohibited by the National Labor Relations Act. So it's a very comprehensive, it's a field preemption. There are definitely exceptions to it, but they are for things like trespass actions by picketers or things like this that deal more with the traditional police power of maintaining order outside of the workplace. So as long as something's arguably prohibited because, say, the union demands to bargain for union security and the employer refuses, then the union can go to the National Labor Relations Board, file a charge for bad faith bargaining, and argue that there's been an unfair labor practice. In order to make sure that the NLRB makes that decision, states are kept out. They can't have laws that differ. They can't have laws that are more protective, and they can't have laws that have different remedies. So it's to create uniformity again. So Ray mentioned that in the 50s there were cases in California. In the 60s there was a case here in Kentucky from the Court of Appeals, which was then the High Court. And in the 90s there was a case in New Mexico. So this is not a brand new issue. It is an issue that has been addressed multiple times in the past. And all of those courts until the recent Sixth Circuit panel found that the NLRA Garmin preempted the local right to work ordinances. I'd like to read some language from the Puckett case. The court reasoned that Section 14B is a special exception out of the full preemption by the NLRA of states and localities regulating union security agreements. As an exception, departing from the overall spirit and purpose of the Act, Section 14B must be strictly and narrowly construed. So there's definitely a qualitative difference, as those opinions have recognized, between having 50 different laws versus having thousands of localities with different laws. Some might have criminal provisions in them, some might not, some might have one agency enforcing them, some might have the court enforcing them. So this could give rise to quite a number of varying things, and employers, unions, and employees would have to be researching in every jurisdiction and would have to be bargaining differently in every jurisdiction. So the Supreme Court has noted that legislative intent is the keystone as to any act to decide whether the preemption pertains or not. And when we look at, we took an exhaustive look in the article, my co-authors and I, at every time the word state is used in the National Labor Relations Act. And in the Act, they do use localities or other words to indicate localities when that was intended. In fact, in 14A, which was enacted at the same time during Taft-Hartley as 14B, it includes the words that indicate localities are included, whereas here it just says state. So if you're interested in that rundown about all the times that state is used in the Act, then you can easily find my article. My name's Ariana Levinson, and you can click on that article either on the Federalist Society webpage, or you can go directly to SSRN and type in my name. You will be able to see that article and every other article that I've written. And then in terms of the legislative history, we did the same thing with the help of a librarian in the law school here. We went through the legislative history, and it provides, as the Puckett case stated, for broad preemption with a narrow exception or saving clause just for states to enact right-to-work ordinances. And I'll quote to you, this is from House Report 245 from the Committee on Education and Labor. Quote, since by the Labor Act, Congress preempts the field that the Act covers, the committee has provided expressly in Section 13, which became 14B, that laws and constitutional provisions of any state that restrict the right of employers to require employees to become or remain members of labor organizations are valid, notwithstanding any provision of the National Labor Relations Act. They also, in the House report, so that speaks to the uniformity, and then they speak to the expertise of the board. They say, quote, as under the present act, the powers of the board under the amended act in the matter of unfair labor practice is exclusive. This rule has necessitated a special provision, basically, to give states the ability to pass right-to-work ordinances. So there's two cases that have been relied on and were relied on by the Sixth Circuit panel in the Hardin County case, and these are two Supreme Court cases. One is Mortier and one is Our Garage, and I think Andrew will probably talk more about them. But Mortier, I would point out, both of them are not about the National Labor Relations Act. Mortier was about the FIFRA. There was a county in Wisconsin that prohibited the use of pesticides, and the Supreme Court found that they could use that. They could pass that ordinance. So it was notable, though, that they emphasized before going into their detailed analysis of the legislative intent that that act did not implicitly field preempt. So it was simply a conflict preemption case. In the other case, Ars Garage, it was about the Interstate Commerce Act, and it was about an ordinance requiring licensing for tow trucks, and it was emphasized in that opinion that it was a safety regulation, which is something states traditionally have power over versus something like an employer and a union entering into a labor contract, which is generally governed by federal law. So those two cases, I think, stand for the proposition that for each act, the court will look at the language of the act, at the legislative history, and figure out what the congressional intent was, which is how lawyers normally do statutory construction. There are other cases that that are, again, not in the NLRA area, but that do support the proposition that a state does not normally include a locality. And these are antitrust cases. And in the antitrust case, the Sherman Act, it doesn't have an explicit exemption for state action, but the court has found that it implicitly permits state action. But although it permits state action, it does not permit local action. And they use language that indicates that that federal entities do not include localities when they talk about states, because the main two entities in the division of power are the federal government and the state government. I might be able to locate some language. Subdivisions are not the equivalent of the states themselves. They are not entitled to the federal deference granted to states. The court noted that given the serious economic dislocation which could result if cities were free to place their own parochial interest above the nation's economic goals, it was particularly unwilling to exempt local action as a form of state action. So in this case with the NLRA, we have the same thing where this creates economic difficulties if we have many local laws. But the court in those cases also goes on to address home rule and talks about how home rule is not the type of specific delegation that would enable a local action to be a state action. And so in the right-to-work context, if you have a state right-to-work law, then the state has clearly articulated a policy. If they don't have a state right-to-work law, it doesn't make sense that they would then have to pass a law saying we confirm the federal default. The default is there unless you pass the state law. So the localities shouldn't be able to pass all these, and then the state have to override that when that is already the default, is not to have right-to-work. And then finally, just briefly to mention the Sixth Circuit's panel decision in Hardin County. First of all, in this decision, the court found that the Garvin preemption is a field preemption of union security. But they went on to find that the term state, as used in 14B, included localities. They did not address anything about the language of the NLRA or the legislative history and the Taft-Hartley amendments. Rather, they relied on a Sixth Circuit proposition that there has to be a clear statement to the contrary if Congress wants to only mean state with states and not preserve the state's ability to delegate to localities. So without addressing the language of the statute, the legislative history, or looking at the intent, it seems that that is maybe within the formality of Mortier and Argerage, but is not within the spirit of figuring out what the legislative intent is. And with that, I'm ready to hand it over to Andrew.
Andrew, go ahead.
Sure. So thanks for having me to talk about this. I'll just go over, I think, some of the cases themselves in the Sixth Circuit, because this is a very important issue. I'd also like just to preface that, just to say that I'm not anti-union here. I'm more of a localist, and so I'm more interested in the preemption questions. And this is one of the rare cases where unions are pro-preemption, because they're usually anti-preemption. This case has a huge, I think, political valence, or at least it did until the election, because groups like ALEC and the like were thinking that the key to pro-market reforms in the United States was going to be primarily at the state level. But that may change, and it might be interesting to hear what the other panelists had to say about what we may expect with respect to this issue from the Department of Labor. So anyways, I'm glad I keep a defibrillator on hand, because when I hear legislative intent is a keystone to preemption, I kind of have to check myself. So anyways, this case, this Sixth Circuit opinion, and it was argued on October 18th, 2016, and it was decided and filed a month later, which is very quick turnaround. It was decided on November 18th. From what I heard, petition for rehearing en banc has been filed before the Sixth Circuit. However, the Kentucky's House just passed the statewide right-to-work ordinance, and the expectation is that the Senate will also pass it and that the governor will sign it, which means that while the rehearing en banc petition is pending, the case may be mooted. So presumably that means, barring any sort of exceptional circumstance, I would expect that the Sixth Circuit decision will remain binding precedent in the Sixth Circuit, unless the Sixth Circuit does something strange en banc and summarily vacates the decision. So the panel was judges Danny Boggs, who was a Reagan appointee, Richard Serlinreich, who's a senior H.W. Bush appointee, and the author of the opinion was David McKeague, who was a George W. Bush appointee. The district court opinion arises out of the Hardin County, Kentucky local right-to-work ordinance that was passed on January 13, 2015. The lawsuit was immediately filed by union groups in the federal district court, and the district court issued the decision over a year later, which took a long time. The judge was David Hale, who's an Obama appointee, and for whom this case was probably one of his first cases as a judge, so he spent some time with it. The opinion, the district court opinion, is a short one. It's under 10 pages, and it's short on facts because Judge Hale honed in on the clean legal question of, at issue, which is, in his words, if the Kentucky right-to-work ordinance, if Ordinance 300 constitutes state law within the meaning of Section 14B, is it valid and enforceable? Section 14B is the crux of this entire teleform, and it reads, again, nothing in this act shall be construed as authorizing the execution or application of agreements requiring membership in a labor organization as a condition of employment in any state or territory in which such execution or application is prohibited by state or territorial law. So put more plainly, the NLRA doesn't mandate union membership in a state where state law is right to work. So Judge Hale rightly noted in his district court opinion that the term state or territory is used twice in the statute, so that as a matter of ordinary statutory construction, it makes sense to read the two as the same in pari materia, and an example is helpful. So imagine Hardin County's local right-to-work ordinance is not preempted. Wouldn't this mean that Hardin County has rendered closed shop arrangements unenforceable throughout Kentucky? That wouldn't make any sense. And since right-to-work was prohibited by state or territorial law, wouldn't that mean that the NRLA through Section 14B wouldn't apply to any part of Kentucky, or at least these provisions? So read this way, Judge Hale concluded that it would be illogical to assume that 14B allowed local right to work because it would compel two different readings of state or territory. But this is actually false, because following Ordinance 300, the only type of closed shop arrangements prohibited in Kentucky were closed shop arrangements in Hardin County. In other words, state or territory in 14B is used the same way twice, and Judge Hale was perhaps being a bit uncharitable. So that's really the statutory argument. Judge Hale goes on, however, to discuss so-called Garmin preemption, which is a bit of a non sequitur here because of the explicit exception language in 14B. Garmin was a 1959 decision by Justice Frankfurter for a unanimous court that would give Scalia, also give him heart attacks, although anyways. Basically, Justice Frankfurter said that judicial process was necessary to fill in the gaps to vindicate congressional intent in a giant contradictory statutory mess, which to me sounds a lot like what the court may have done in the Obamacare decisions. As Frankfurter said in Garmin, much is left to the states, but quote, though Congress has refrained from telling us how much is left to the states. So how do we determine what is preempted? Well, the correct answer is in a slew of Supreme Court cases, including some that the professor mentioned, but I'll quote Justice Stevens's decision in the Wyeth case from several terms ago, is that absent a clear and manifest purpose to preempt, the presumption in American law is that states and thus locales have regulatory authority in an area. So this part of black letter preemption law would control today, but the Garmin case was decided in the heady days of the Warren Court before the Federalism Revolution. And Garmin says that to allow, quote, the states to control activities that are potentially subject to federal regulation involves too great a danger of conflict with national labor policy. So per Garmin, the NLRA is a one-off exception to ordinary preemption norms. And maybe the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation might want to challenge Garmin at some point. More important than that, however, Garmin is a bit of a non sequitur here because it is obviously subject to statutory exceptions like 14B. The question is not does the NLRA preempt state law, which it generally does, and which the Sixth Circuit opinion said that it does. The question is, does 14B create an exception to the general preemption rule? And I think also in this case, it obviously does. The effects of local right to work on various aspects of labor law can't bear on the question, because that would mean that state right to work laws would be preempted as well. But the clear text of 14B allows state right to work laws. And so the question is one of the clear text and the exception, not of Garmin preemption. And that's really exactly what the Sixth Circuit said when it reversed the Western District of Kentucky. It said that, quote, Congress can hardly be deemed to have implicitly intended to preempt a state law that it has explicitly accepted from preemption. So the main question really is not one of whether the NLRA has broad preemptive effect, which it does. The question is one of the specific statutory exception in 14B, and it's one of agency law. Is local law state law for the purposes of 14B? In other words, can Congress pass a law preempting a field and then allow states and their subdivisions to have limited freedom to regulate or not to regulate within that field? And did Congress do it in the 14B context? The answer, I think, is yes. Under our federal system, the states are sovereign, and it's the states which, by compact, form the federal government, and it is states which govern within their territories. Independent local governments, sovereigns within sovereigns, would be unthinkable. The only exceptions are things like Indian tribes and religious bodies. As expressed in Dillon's rule adopted by the Supreme Court in the 1907 case of Hunter v. Pittsburgh, it turns out that, quote, municipal corporations are political subdivisions of the state, created as convenient agencies for exercising such of the governmental powers of the state as may be entrusted to them. The number, nature, and duration of the powers conferred upon these corporations and the territory over which they shall be exercised rests in the absolute discretion of the state. So I'm not trying to cite that case as binding precedent in the NLRA context, but I'm just to explain the counterfactual. If Kentucky wanted to allow agency shop contracts in Hardin County, it could easily do so by passing a law to that effect. As it stands, though, Kentucky has designated Hardin County's board as an agent of the state authorized to exercise some portion of the sovereign powers of that state under 14B. And pursuant to that delegation, Hardin County passed a right-to-work ordinance. And in fact, Kentucky so liked what Hardin County did that it has now passed or is about to pass a statewide right-to-work law, which I think even strengthens that case. So just as a brief coda to this, since we are running over, I'll just say, why do we want localism? Why would we prefer to have different subdivisions of states or states versus the federal government determine more issues? I think there are many reasons. You could come up with many reasons. One is the creative destruction of the market argument, the laboratories of democracy idea. A second is the political economy point, which is that Congress is very difficult to lobby. And when you say, if you want right to work in a locale, you should just have Congress pass a law. Well, it's much easier to lobby a specific locale than it is to lobby Congress. And so there's a decentralizing effect of localism. There's a decentralizing lobbying efforts is pro-democratic, I think, in a pretty classical liberal sort of way. The third reason we might want localism, it reminds me of the rabbi's prayer for the czar and Fiddler on the Roof, where he goes, "May God bless him and keep him far away from here." We like to govern ourselves, and that has dignitary benefits. A fourth reason for localism is that we may simply need a decision rule to resolve ambiguity in the positive law, and that an anti-preemptive rule is as good as any. It's a rule of the road. That's a pretty weak argument, but I think that's also important here. We have that presumption against preemption, and I think in this 14B context, the Sixth Circuit correctly decided that sort of presumption is in favor of Hardin County being able to pass their local right-to-work ordinance. So with that, I'll pass it on for questions. I have my own curiosities about the economy, cross-border issues, and all of that, but I'll pass it on.
Nate, how many questioners do we have lined up?
Let me just open up the floor for them, and we will find out immediately. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, please enter star, then the pound sign. Go ahead, Raymond.
Yeah, well, we're having questions submitted, hopefully. Let me ask the panelists, at least Ariana and Andrew, the two lawyers, what's the effect of the new state law on the pending Hardin County case?
Yeah, when Kentucky passes right to work, which we do expect to happen on Saturday, then that will definitely preempt the Hardin County and all the other 11 counties' local right-to-work ordinances. We had a recent decision regarding the Louisville minimum wage, which had been placed higher than the state minimum, and that Kentucky Supreme Court case makes clear that whenever there's a comprehensive regulation at the state level, then despite home rule, the local laws will be preempted. So that will preempt those local right-to-ordinances. That should moot the case, but of course this would be before we've learned whether the Sixth Circuit is going to ask for a response to the petition for rehearing. So it's possible that the union might seek, or the court en banc might just decide to take the decision off the books.
So I address this very briefly. I think so. The state law question is obviously up to Kentucky as to what local laws are. I mean, I'm not utterly familiar with how this will interplay with other local ordinances on the books. As far as the question the Sixth Circuit addressed in the Hardin County case, it squarely addressed the meaning of the NLRA, and that is a final decision that is on the books unless and until the Sixth Circuit en banc reverses it or the Supreme Court issues some contrary ruling. I think my expectation is that the state law will mean that the Sixth Circuit will simply decline to hear the will simply dismiss the case, or decline to hear it en banc, and then that the panel decision will remain binding circuit precedent.
And I did want to mention that I was actually able to attend the argument in the Sixth Circuit, and there were some interesting themes that came out during the oral argument that didn't really come out in the opinion. So one thing that seemed clear was that the judges did not want to have federal interference into state matters, but ironically, by ruling the way that they did, now any time an unfair labor practice charge is filed that deals with union security or with one of these local right-to-work ordinances, the NLRB will be having to decide whether Home Rule actually authorizes that local right-to-work ordinance or not.
Would the decision be binding on the board?
I don't know that the board, you know, the board has its own jurisprudence, and when it has a Supreme Court ruling to the contrary, it follows the Supreme Court ruling. If it were filed in the Sixth Circuit, they would be likely to follow it, but they don't necessarily follow the Sixth Circuit, and certainly not for the cases that would arise in the Seventh Circuit or any other place that passes those laws. It was also interesting because one of the judges asked why they would want to spend time looking into the legislative history when they could just use this presumption. So it seemed a little bit like the fact that the courts are under-resourced and overwhelmed might have factored into it as well.
Nate, do we have any questions pending?
No, we do not, but let me give the reminder to the audience just in case they missed it. If you want to request the floor and ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign. Also, just one other announcement that we'd like to make. Just a programming note for our next teleforum, which is scheduled on Monday the 9th at 1:15 p.m. That call will discuss the upcoming public school transgender bathroom case before the Supreme Court, Gloucester County School Board v. GG, and that call will feature Kyle Duncan, who is the attorney representing Gloucester County School Board. Raymond, we still do not have any questions. Please feel
okay.
free to
I've got another proceed. Question. I think Andrew may have just briefly referred to this in passing, but would the analysis in this as to this issue be different? Under Algoma Plywood, states have pretty broad discretion to regulate right to work. And that, for example, in that case, it wasn't a prohibition of force fee agreements, but merely a state requirement that there be a 3/4 vote of the bargaining unit to adopt a force fee agreement. What would the analysis here be different if Kentucky had the state legislature had explicitly passed a law making it a local option as to whether to be right to work?
Right. I've thought about that question. I think that the outcome remains the same because the Garmin preempts both state and local actions as to union security, and 14B exempts only state actions and not local actions. But even if, for argument's sake, a state could explicitly and clearly say that we're delegating that choice to localities, it doesn't make much sense in the context where you either have states that have an adopted right to work and what they intend is to have the default, not to have to pass their own legislation that reestablishes the federal default, or you have states that have passed right to work, in which case it's not necessary for the localities to do so.
Wouldn't Algoma Plywood be pretty persuasive? Because in Algoma Plywood, what the Supreme Court said Wisconsin could do was delegate the decision to the employees in the bargaining unit.
Well, Algoma Plywood dealt with that you can have different variations, such as having the 3/4 requirement, and that goes along with the idea that when you have all these different local jurisdictions doing different things, whether it's different votes, majority, a higher majority, or you have them doing things like criminalizing this type of conduct, then you have this, what one of the courts I think called a patchwork quilt of local regulation.
So if I could just jump in here, one of the things the professor just said I think is a bit circular. It's not the case that when a state fails to pass a statewide right to work law, that the default must be, the intent must be presumed that the state wants these sorts of arrangements, these sorts of closed shop contracts to be available statewide. And I also don't think that it's not the case that Kentucky didn't explicitly delegate authority. That's what the home rule statute is. So that is an explicit delegation of the sovereign authority of Kentucky to statute and its constitution to make these sorts of decisions. So, and this is not some sort of sky is falling situation. It's very simple if there's a problem here for Congress to repeal 14B or amend 14B. I mean, 14B wasn't in the original NLRA. It came with the amendments that later. So, as Ray said at the outset. So I think that in all of these cases, unless and until there's a federal problem that needs to be addressed through legislation, the presumption ought to be local control and allowing states to delegate their authority. It would be very strange. I don't know how one would have federal law apply a non-delegation doctrine to the states. That would raise huge practical problems, among other problems.
It's also worth noting, Andrew, that the Supreme Court in that Algona Plywood decision expressly held that right to work is an exercise of police power that is protecting workers from coercion. And so that's why the court ruled that the original National Labor Relations Act did not regulate. It wasn't exactly right to work, but any form of regulation of compulsory dues, the court ruled, look, this is an exercise of police power. Unless Congress is expressly intruding in this zone, which the original act didn't do, then we're not going to imply preemption where Congress isn't stating it. And then what you had with 14B is with Taft-Hartley, the Congress was amending the act, and they were prohibiting a number of union practices like the union shop and the clothes shop, where you have to belong to the union before you start working at the company in order to get a job. And that raises the question of are you thereby preempting this field of union security regulation? And the congressional record shows very clearly that they were adding 14B to make it clear that no, we're not affecting the state's authority regulated this matter. We're simply saying some things are off limits, but if states want to pass laws of their own, we're not intruding any new federal preemption. So if the federal preemption didn't exist to begin with the original act, and Congress wasn't intending to add it in the Taft-Hartley amendments, it's hard to see how you then imply a level of preemption coming in here. Nonetheless, that oh, local governments, you've lost your power. The original NLRA did not regulate local governments, and the Taft-Hartley amendments were not intended to regulate local governments. So there's and particularly in something dealing with the local police powers, where the local authority and the state authority assumed to be at its highest ebb, so to speak, vis-a-vis federal preemption.
Well, to that, I would say that we definitely disagree about the preemptive effect of the National Labor Relations Act and the Taft-Hartley Act, and that we have gone through the legislative history, which listeners are welcome to go and look at what we've written, and it makes it clear that this is broad preemption and a narrow exception, just like the Puckett Court said, and that is an exception for state right to work laws, not for local right to work laws. There's obviously a counterpoint to the home rule authority. It is a broad authority that gives economic authority to localities. As to the issue of the police powers, there are well-established exceptions to Garmin preemption for things that fall within that. The language in those opinions I haven't looked at recently, but I do believe it was just an in passing, as this is what would be a police power if it were not preempted, which it is preempted. And then I just wanted to finally say that in terms of the argument about personal liberty, that there are other instances where people are required to do things, and all of us as attorneys who are listening on this call, that are attorneys who are on this panel, know that we, for instance, cannot practice as an attorney unless we join the Bar Association in many states. So that would be my final thoughts to the matter.
Anyone else have a final thought? We're getting upon our hour here.
Well, I'll just add one practical note, is that it's almost no burden whatsoever on unions to deal with these local right-to-work ordinances. All that they need to do is insert in the contract a clause that says, where permitted, your dues will be compulsory. Where it's not permitted by law, they won't be. And this is very standard language that unions include in the contracts when they're negotiating contracts that cover workers in multiple states. There's a large number of union contracts where the bargaining unit spans more than one state. It's just a standard provision they put in there. Forced dues, unless that's contrary to state law. There's almost no additional burden on the union, you know, besides putting that little clause in there. So it's not a crazy, I mean, any more than having, you know, 29 states right to work and 21 states compulsory dues, it's not that much more of a patchwork of regulations, and the solution is exactly the same.
And I'll just end by sort of echoing that and making a slightly snide comment, which is that we have another highly regulated area of American laws is healthcare, and that's an area where we have a huge patchwork of laws. And in the insurance markets, and that seems to be, I mean, is that fine? Is that not fine? I think with technology and all sorts of software that helps manage these sorts of things, the administrative burden of having to handle multiple regulatory regimes, first of all, as James said, there aren't that many regulatory regimes, but I think the administrative burden argument is sort of becoming a little less salient as time goes by.
Okay, Nate, do you want to wind this up?
Yes, very good. I think we've had a great conversation today, and on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank all of our guests for speaking with us. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.